In tech we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
Hi, and welcome to episode 11 of the In Tech We Trust podcast. Today I am joined on my left-hand side with a smell of bacon. Welcome, Gabriel. How was this week?
This week was actually pretty cool and somewhat relaxing. So it's nice to, after several months of hectic travel, to kind of downshift a little bit and spend some time with the family.
Mm-hmm. What do you do professionally when you're at home?
Professionally, I look after children and dogs, and then lately I've been forced to endure the horrible 70-degree winter that we're currently facing and the massive dry conditions. So it's, as all my poor friends in the East who are buried under feet of snow, I haven't worn pants in a month.
So 70 degrees, how does that translate for the whole world except for that small part that you live in?
I don't know. I failed math.
What can you share a project you're working on?
Yeah. So right now, you know, for me, as I work in sales, so I don't necessarily have projects per se necessarily that are almost always defined. I am working with a few very large customers on some projects that they're working on that I'm not always necessarily available to discuss in public, but talking right now with some folks over at WePro, who are a large service integrator, around some VDI stuff. Lots of discussion around OpenStack, specifically around Cinder, Swift implementations, and high-density storage servers, storage platforms. And then, as always, a lot of my focus is primarily around storage products with inside Cisco. So that covers everything from, you know, even MDS to Invicta to, you know, even Fusion IO inside the system. So it's pretty broad.
Yeah, nice portfolio of products to have on your hands there. So next up, and our final co-host of today, is our pater familias, keeping our youngster Nigel with his feet on the ground when he starts dreaming of containers again. It's the inimitable Mark Farley, from whom I am dying to hear how the Beer Guild visit was. How was that?
Oh, yeah, the Brewers Guild visit was very nice. It was in a tiny little place. I can't remember the name. Isn't that terrible? But they made the yerba mate beer, which, you know, they're selling regionally. And it was great. I learned about dry hopping. And since then, my rocket science partner, Tony, and I have dry hopped our first batch of beer.
Awesome.
And, you know, so we already, the cooking went much better. This was also our first batch that was all grain. Instead of brewing from an extract, we boiled it down from all grain. And from preliminary taste test, you know, you check the density of the beer, the specific gravity, and we take it from a primary fermentation to a secondary one. And at the time you sample some of it, it's much better. Mm-hmm. And now it was definitely a hoppier brew just from the cooking. Mm-hmm. And now with dry hopping, I'm really looking forward to seeing what it's like in a couple of weeks. Meanwhile, my own beer, the first batch that we brewed at my house here, is taking its time. I opened a bottle a couple days ago, and it was a couple days too early. You know, the carbonation happens in the bottle. You put a little bit of sugar stuff in the batch, and then you bottle it. And the yeast that's still suspended in the beer, you know, works on that in the sugars that are in there and converts it to CO2 and alcohol. But that's where the carbonation comes from. And apparently it hasn't worked long enough because it was flat and not that great. So going to have to probably give it another week. And hopefully it will liven up a little bit. It'll get some bubbles. And if it doesn't, I'm not sure what I'm going to do. Probably run it through my soda stream to get some CO2.
You can always keep it for cooking.
Yeah, but the Brewers Guild was great. Just the information on the dry hopping was really important. You know, the hops have a lot of oils in them. Mm-hmm. And apparently what happens is the hops that you put in early does provide some bitterness into yes. into the beer, but it really is then part of the recipe, and it's not aromatic because the oils boil off as you're boiling the malt. So the dry hopping that you put in at the end, or actually when we moved it to secondary fermentation, you just put the hops in there, and so all the oils then stay in the beer, and that's the stuff that gives it the nose, right? The smell, the odor of the hops. Yep. And so I'm really, really looking forward to seeing how this batch turned out. It has a great color. It had a great taste early on. And I think it's, you know, it will be our best batch. Mm-hmm. There's no question about it. So I'm very excited about that.
Awesome. Next time you're going to throw in four times the amount of hops at the end, and then you're going to have an American style IPA.
Well, you know, for us to do that, we'll really have to amp up the malt too. Because if you want it balanced, right, you've got to have enough.
Have you ever drunk an American IPA? That's not balanced at all.
Oh no, they're hoppy, right? I mean, yeah. Well, yeah. So you know, you European guys, you don't like this super bitter stuff. Yeah, right. So in order to do the high hops, you have to do the high alcohol content, right? That's where the balance comes from. Is you put a lot more yeast food in there to make more alcohol. And yeah, like a Stone Ruination, you know, a beer like that, which I happen to really like, it is bitter. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really hoppy. But in order to do that, you have to push the alcohol up. And we're not making high alcoholic beer yet. But it's you know what, it's really not my call. My friend Tony, the rocket scientist, he's really doing this stuff. I mean, he measures the pH of the water, makes sure that, you know, he's doing all of that stuff. He's like a chemist. Watching him work, it's like working with Walter White. You know, I feel like Aaron Paul watching, you know, Walter White at work.
Awesome. Well, I could talk for hours about beers, you know. I just had Chris Wall on a visit here in Belgium after we did three different V-mugs. We went from UK Birmingham to Denmark Copenhagen, and then our own V-mug in Antwerp in Belgium. And he stayed over for the weekend. So we toured from Bruges to Ghent to Brussels, and he went home with a whole duffel bag of beers and chocolates and yeah, he had one separate bag just for the beers and the chocolates, and it was just under the weight that was allowed to bring on a plane. So good on you, Chris, and I hope you and your family enjoy a lot of it. So
yeah, good move, Chris. Yeah, way to go.
So when you ever want to come drinking decent high alcohol beers, you come over here, Mark.
I'll have a quack with you then.
Yeah, definitely. So this week we are missing the Ricotron again. He's been pulled away at the very last minute. So it's all good there, but it's going to cost you, Ricotron. I mean, it's going to cost you one of those high alcohol beers over here. And you may have noticed, but we are missing Nigel. He's now negotiating a $1 billion investment in container ships in the Middle East. I think he has missed the container boat there. After 10 episodes, it is a good thing to look back and look forward. So we did miss a little bit in our show last week talking about that 10th episode. So I want to take that time here for a little minute. We've looked at the statistics, and I can say that we had over 8,000 downloads altogether already. So, good on us. I think starting from scratch, we haven't done a lot of marketing and buzz around it, and every single show till now has at least 500 downloads, which I think is quite good for something that is only 10 weeks old. And the best one today was the VSA versus VSAN conversation we had in Barcelona, and that one had over 1,400 downloads. So, I mean,
no.
Yeah, I think those are nice numbers to start off with. We also see a steep growth.
That was a show I wasn't on, so I think that has something to do with that.
I'm guessing that's research. Also equally. Yeah.
I think it may have to do something with the content as such, rather than the people that were on, but that's how it was. We do see a steep growth in the amount of downloads the day after publication. So that means that we are growing listeners. Thank you for spreading the word of mouth. I do want to emphasize that although we're quite opinionated people ourselves, we do tend to touch on topics of which none of us necessarily have hands-on experience. So I would like to encourage you to chime in on our LinkedIn discussions and bringing that conversation a lot further than the show alone. So the only thing we intend to do with the show is bringing you the news, but we'd rather have a good discussion afterwards with you. Maybe you have more experience than we do. And with that, I want to go into some of the news of this week. But with more of a general topic first, is archiving a horrible word to take into your mouth. Gartner released a enterprise archiving Magic Quadrant. Yay. So I don't like Gartner, and I specifically don't like Magic Quadrants. But this one did raise a few questions. Winners of the leaders quadrant were HP, Commvault, and Symantec, which is not to be surprised about. But what did surprise me was the comments that came along with those first places. And for HP, that was a complex and less than intuitive admin interface, less than perfect customer support, and a sometimes lengthy deployment. That's not really for a leader. And Commvault had the exact same comments. Sales team sometimes struggles to get the compliance message across. Licensing can be confusing, especially combined with backup. And the console is complex and overbuilt. Help me out here, brothers. What is wrong with archiving?
Oh, what's wrong with archiving? It's horribly difficult. Horribly difficult task. Right?
So help me out here. Help me understand why the leaders in a specific quadrant get this much bad press of being a leader. How can it not be a good product?
Ooh, how can something not be a good product? Because the task is so difficult to do that it's that no matter, and the requirements are so varied that across the board, and this is why you've got the complexity in the dashboards, is there are so many requirements that come up that trying to integrate them all in, it's very difficult. There's not just a point and shoot. Two customers won't agree on what the top priorities are, right? And so you end up with lots of different things and a great deal of complexity. It's just a hard area. Very tough.
Yeah, I would echo that as well. I think, you know, unfortunately, it's not traditional backup. It is archiving, and there are different sets of retentions available for every single customer. Some of that data needs to be encrypted. Some of it needs to be kept indefinitely. Other parts of it just need to have a faster refresh rate or a retrieval rate. And I talked to a lot of people in the media and entertainment space around this, and it's a huge challenge for every one of them. And no two customers that I've talked to have the exact same set of requirements. So you can't be, it's like, you know, when you're a hammer, everything's a nail. And unfortunately, you know, you cannot customize it to that specific level based on each customer's requirmental specs.
You do bring up a good point there, Gabriel, as in archiving is not the same as backups. And it's maybe good for our audience to make sure that we kind of set the level of the definition here, as in archiving is not just long-term retention. Archiving as such has nothing to do with retention at all. Archiving is the black art of strategically deleting your data from your primary storage.
See, I don't agree with you at all, and there's the problem. I think archiving is keeping objects that you want to have together, you know, together for whatever purpose. Because there's a lot of archiving where people say, especially in healthcare, where people say you never delete anything, right? There's just no point in deleting it because you have to keep stuff for life of the patient. Well, who knows how long that is? You can't even track that, so you might as well keep it forever.
Well, yeah,
right.
Yeah, deleting was a wrong choice of words here. I mean, removing, replacing, moving it to a different location other than your primary. Archiving is, by definition, making your primary storage smaller.
It depends on the customer. So, like, look at the National Archives, and look at the breadth and scope of things that they keep. Essentially, every government document has to be, you know, every email correspondence. There are some really strange requirements around specific customer use cases. For them, it's basically keeping a living history in real time of everything that's transcribed across, you know, government wires or government, you know, emails or communications or texts, all of that stuff, and you have to keep it indefinitely.
That has nothing to do with archive. Archiving for me is making sure that the data does not reside in your workloads.
Yeah, so let's just talk about that for a second, Hans. So let's say, okay, I've got too much data here on my primary storage, and I know it's not being used, right? So I've got a lot of stuff that's, you know, 6 months old, a year old, 18 months old, 2 years old, whatever, of this certain size, and it's taking up this capacity, and it's not being accessed anymore, right? So, you know, you want to archive that off to secondary storage. You say, okay, let's archive it. But what about the end users, right? As an IT guy, you say, I'm going to clean this stuff out. But the end user, then as soon as you clean it out, somebody's going to come up and say, I can't find this, that, or the other thing. Right. And so then you have to ask the questions, how do you archive to make it transparent to end users? Or do you want to make it transparent to end users? Or how do you want to do it? Because if you make it transparent to end users, then you get into technology like stubbing, where you leave a stub file behind. And nobody's really done a great job with implementing stubbing, because it the way it works or doesn't work with backup, you know, all kinds of hairy, thorny issues come about, right? I mean, even just the simple idea that says I'm going to clean up old data from primary storage becomes complicated, because end users have expectations. And at the end of the day, those are the expectations that matter the most, and they're all over the map.
Yeah, I totally get your point, but that is the whole question that I have here. Why has no one been able to make that transparent better than the cumbersome and complex and less than intuitive and all those adjectives that I'm seeing here in front of my screen?
Well, the person that does that is going to be the person that can basically retire after the first product ships, because everybody's going to want to buy that. You know, we still say it's the same amount of complexity in just that archival space for, you know, around, you know, identification of the metadata with inside something of that thing. Think about this. Every written book that's ever been put into the catalog system in the U.S. and categorizing and understanding and, you know, all of the data points around those, all the metadata associated with that stuff, it's a massive undertaking. The storage companies, not storage, the storage companies, but the software companies, your Commvaults, your, you know, or even, you know, the products around that space, they're kind of focused on the lowest common denominator, the easy thing where we can check certain boxes, but they've not orchestrated the real true, you know, they've not been able to abstract away the true complexity within that particular space to a, you know, the kind of interface people are accustomed to with their traditional backup software. Right, because like I said, the requirements for each customer are almost unique.
One of the tough parts here is how much companies can invest in an archiving product, right? If archiving's not anybody's big income stream, not their big revenue stream. And so, you know, if you, you know, how much can you realistically expect to spend, and how much new development are people willing to do, right? So a lot of the archiving products too are based on older technology, or they came about as extensions to other things that already existed, right? An extension to an email system, an extension to backup. And so they're not built from the ground up to be archiving. And that makes it very hard also.
So wouldn't the challenge be there then to simplify, to make a simple product that has a lower CapEx cost to broaden the market? Because like you say, and that's what I'm seeing, I don't see anyone other than big enterprises using this, but I do see a lot of value in it for every mid-size customer. Like for example, today, if you are replacing your existing storage array with a brand new Pure Storage, all flash, blah, 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 I don't want to have my dead data on that more expensive all flash array.
Yeah, that's called S3. Or sorry, Glacier.
No, you're talking about location. I'm talking about we need software to do that for me. And that's something we don't have. That archiving software only works for enterprises, one, because you need a whole team to run it, and two, because it's fairly expensive.
But the place that you store it, though, really is important.
Yeah. I mean, look at Black Pearl, you know, what Spectralogic's doing around Black Pearl, which I find is actually kind of an interesting technology, right? So, you know, it's about, for them, it's more around moving the data to different tiers of area where you can either retrieve it quickly or keep it in deep storage. And it's going from, you know, from the data center to a compute environment, or to, you know, within their gateway to some LTFS tape system someplace, or possibly integrated into a cloud provider. You know, that's only one part of the puzzle, though. The software to orchestrate all that. You know, you have to have, I mean, is it two HP or Commvaults benefit to partner with them and provide something that works end to end with that, knowing the full well that they have to do the same thing with Quantum and a few others. So I think what happens is you hit the software vendors who don't have a hardware solution trying to be all things to everybody and not doing any of them very well. And then you have the hardware vendors at the bottom end who are trying to provide the infrastructure, but are also competing with everybody else in the same space. So there's no perfect mix. There's not one company that provides a seamless end-to-end solution right now. Yeah. It's, you know, it, from my interpretation of the marketplace, and to be honest, I've gotten out of what I would consider backup and archival a while back. So, you know, maybe my expertise are limited in the space, but if I'm looking at it from a standpoint of the products that I see in the marketplace today, there is no, you know, universal platform that does it. And I think, you know, probably HP is probably focused the more effort on it than some of the other major vendors.
Yeah. Storage people might say that, well, we're going to cover that that working set in storage itself and blocks that are never being used. We're going to put that somewhere on Glacier. And you could solve it on a storage layer. But then that means that you keep all your data in your primary front end.
So I think where this is going to be maybe not solved, but get a significant step up is you know, I don't want to use this podcast too much as a platform to talk about what we're doing at Quadra, but I think I can talk about it as file analytics and the space of what analytics is doing and how that can help out, right? Just a little bit of history. In my previous job at Microsoft with StorSimple, we built a tiered storage system that moved data through SSD layer, disk layer, and then used a cloud layer. Mm-hmm. And we had metadata about the blocks, right? So we would, you know, we broke everything. It was all block data that came in through iSCSI, and we would age out those blocks. And as the blocks became old enough, then we would send them to the cloud. We didn't know what file that belonged to. And, you know, for some customers, it didn't matter. But for a lot of customers, they wanted to know and they needed to know what was in the cloud. So that was insufficient. Quadra, and, you know, you look at what Data Gravity is doing, right? The idea that says, and other people doing file analytics, you know, look at the stuff that is stored here and keep metadata about it and look inside the content itself to see, you know, which kind of files they are, what that content is. You can look at how it's aged, you know, if it's photography data, for instance, you could get XF data out of it. There's you can get, you know, ownership. You can know what customer it's about, if it contains sensitive information or not. You can get all of that information and manage it in a metadata system and then make decisions about moving it offsite and all of those kinds of things. And this is great. I'll just talk a little bit about how this is at Quadra so far. So we're keeping all of this metadata, and you can write to different, we support a couple different cloud interfaces. So we're not really selling the product yet. You know, it's like we consider it beta level product. You know, you could store it on S3, you could store it in OpenStack Swift. But what we don't have right now is stubbing for it. So when you move that data, and the end user could come, you know, if they try to open that file, it's like, well, they'll get that file back. The access to it might be a little slower, but they could still get access to it, and it would show up in their file system transparently. That would be great. We don't have that in there. The other thing that we don't have that I think people are going to want with analytics systems like this is end user search, right? You know, if the users are smart enough to know that when data is missing, that they need to search for it, and you've got the ability then for to give every end user an interface, and that interface supports all of the secure the right security credentials to access the stuff through search, you know, then people could say, I'm looking for this file. It's got these characteristics. It was made in this date. It was about this customer, about that product. You do a search. Boom. There you go. You get it. Right. That would be the thing that's kind of the holy grail. And that doesn't exist yet. Mm-hmm. And the existing products, I don't think really have the database structure to do it. They don't scale properly. They're not fast enough. I mean, this is a massive scaling problem. Right. And especially as you're storing more and more data, it gets to be petabyte range and billions of objects. And most of these archiving systems break down. They can't really track that much stuff and keep going with it. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a future there. And I think my opinion is, and I've got a vested interest in it, so I need to be careful about it. I think the future is going to be around file analytics that will bring this stuff to a usable state where people won't just cuss and swear and say, yeah. You know, the funny thing about this magic quadrant that Gartner just published is there probably shouldn't have been any products in it. Right, because it's Gartner, they had to stick something in. But realistically, everything, there shouldn't be anything in that top right quarter,
because nothing really addresses it fully and completely with the completeness of vision, aka some Gartner terminology. I mean, if you think about it this way, the largest pool of unstructured data that any company has is their backup and archives, and they don't know what or where most of it is. Right, they don't have the kind of, you know, you want to talk about big data. There's your big data for you, understanding all of that information and effectively managing it down to the individual file or block level.
So summarizing your comments, Mark, on there should not be anyone in that top side of the quadrant, maybe we could use, in the land of the blind, one eye is king.
Well, if you're Gartner, you have to put something there,
So you said it, and maybe I got a good segue here into our next industry news part, where you said, well, we can write to Azure, we could write to other parts. Could it also write to Azure blobs that are going tits up for hours?
Well, the Store Simple product certainly does and did, and I'm not going to comment on things that I heard about what happened there, you know, in this last week, but sure.
Yeah. I haven't heard specifically about the product going down. The Azure storage blobs went down, and I think it was 12 of the 15 areas they have around the world, which is, for me, global. Brazil was still online, and maybe Japan or so. But that was all. And if your storage goes down, your compute can be online as long as it wants. The bigger question here is, we know that sometimes something can go down. And in fact, maybe we should give the origin of the issue was there was a performance update on the storage blobs. And then the blob somehow, the front end of it went into an infinite loop. So that's what happened. But it took, I think, about 11 hours to get back online. And all that together means that they'll never be able to keep their own SLA, to keep the amount of nines they sell, because they'll need about 80 years now without downtime to get back to that with all the nines they're selling. So what's the value of an SLA that a cloud provider gives you if they can go down for 11 hours with hardly any communication to satisfy their customers?
It's going to happen to everyone. It's going to happen to Amazon. It's going to happen to Azure. It's going to happen to SoftLayer and every other one of the providers. The reality is, it's up to the customer to determine what they put in the cloud and to what level of risk they want to take by putting it in there. And if it impacts your SLA, then, or if your SLA is that tight that you can't go down for one of those nines, then you don't put it there. It's up to the customer to determine, is there a certain amount of acceptable risk for me to put this particular workload into a space that has the potential to go down for 11 hours out of a year?
It does not, because that's the whole point. You did not buy that storage to go down 11 hours a year, and that's why they gave you an SLA. So what's the value of an SLA if you can breach it at any point?
If you read – well, there's a couple ways to approach it, right? If you read the terms and conditions of almost any SLA, it's a best effort, right? It's not guaranteed. There are no guarantees. No company is going to give you a guarantee. And if they do, what they're going to do is attach terms and conditions from a monetarily damaged standpoint. So it very may well be that Microsoft writes a big check this week, or you get X number of free hours or days of whatever service they're offering that was affected. And, you know, to the organizations that leverage their services, there's some value to that, right? If you have a really sharp CIO or a sharp, internal team, they're going to attach a specific penalty to the failure to meet an SLA. And if they don't, then, you know, they're leaving money on the table or services on the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one of the points you mentioned there was that everyone's going to go down one day. Something will happen there. So on the update that went on Azure blog, I found in the comments a website called cloudharmony.com, and you can find all the uptime there. So that's a good, maybe a good link for our listeners. If you want to look at the uptimes and compare, because you said everyone goes down. Well, actually, Azure is one of the worst that is in that list of public service providers there. So you can compare Azure to Google, to anyone out there that is doing compute, storage, even DNSs in there, and comparing availability for weeks, months, and also for an entire year. I did look into it, and Azure appears not to be doing the best job there.
Well, this thing is so ridiculously self-inflicted, right? And I mean, to think that a performance upgrade would cause this kind of thing, and that it was inadequately tested. I mean, it was recognized fairly quickly after it was put in production, I believe. It wasn't a case where it had been out there lurking for this bug to all of us. No,
it was immediate.
Well, the question is, Microsoft, how on earth can you roll something out like this and have it immediately cause this? And you're saying it was tested adequately. I'm sorry. That is not, whatever your response is, it's wrong. Yeah. I mean, it was immediate, right? There are other things. Last year, Microsoft had an outage around the holiday season in December. And I don't know if it was, I think it was last year. And it was also a self-inflicted thing, but it was like a latent bug.
Yeah, and it was not a bug. It was the SSL certificate. Issue. That was the best one ever. The SSL certificate of Azure was not updated. So it just stopped.
Oh, no, everything. No. There was another one for storage. I'm not talking about the SSL certificate. Oh. That was a big thing. There was another one that hit storage.
Okay.
And it was because of the way that the Microsoft storage system internally was set up to aggressively recycle unused storage. And something went haywire in there, and this thing, it started to eat itself, basically, and recover data to a free pool.
Was there data loss?
No. They were able to recover it all. It was close.
Yeah, I remember. I do remember that.
And if I'm not mistaken,
there was data loss at certain points.
What happened is that data was inaccessible for a while, but they got it all back. And it's like reaching into the darkness to say, this stuff has been it was like you're going to your undelete and getting stuff out. Mm-hmm. And it was done basically at cloud scale. I'm pretty sure they got it all back. But it was hairy there, and there were customers that were missing data for more than 11 hours, yeah. Right? But the fact that they did this thing, a performance upgrade, and they found out in a very unhappy way right away after they put it on, says that it was inadequately tested and proofed, and that is a shame on them.
Yeah. For me, what is worst for me is that you put up an SLA and it just said, and when you read into the comments of the blog post, the biggest thing that comes back is that they refuse to give updates to their customers whatsoever. So they get an hourly update of "we're busy." I mean, that's not feedback at all. When you have your And maybe, Gabriel, you're right. You shouldn't be doing it, but it there's still production systems running on that, and there's companies relying on that storage with a SQL that is running on top of it that are running their invoice systems and so on. So they should be at least able to communicate with their customers.
No, I totally agree, and I'm not saying that you shouldn't put things there or the cloud's off limits. The point I'm trying to make, though, is that, I'm not saying you don't put your workloads in the cloud. I'm just saying maybe there are certain workloads you don't want to put there, regardless of what SLA they give you, primarily because you don't have full control over your own destiny, mm-hmm. Or your own, your own data or your own processes. And, no matter what the SLA is, I mean, that's, your word's only good as, you're as good as your word type of thing. And the fact is, I mean, it can go down and it does. And large organizations are not necessarily the best when it comes to being forthcoming and transparent for the reasons for why it went down. For me, it just depends. If I'm running a a 5,000 transaction per second type of online business, where if I'm down for 5 minutes during the Christmas season, I lose 20% of my revenue for the year.
Yep.
Probably not going to put it in the cloud.
Well, yeah.
Probably going to keep it internally.
Comes back to my comment of last week with the curry guy. Yeah, you could run anything in the clouds that does not infect your income as a company.
Well, and this is why people want to be able to work with multiple cloud providers, right? And
or that, yes.
Yeah, but I think eventually, years from now, or maybe it even exists right now, when people make their decisions about cloud, they're really going to look at how these things are tested and how upgrades are rolled out. Right now, I think you have to give a leg up to Amazon for what they do with Chaos Monkey. Just let stuff rip out there, but you do it in a fashion that's isolated, where it doesn't go global, right? So if you have a problem, you know how to recover. And it's a case where it was pretty clear that Microsoft didn't have the kind of isolation that they needed for while this upgrade was going on. And it looks like they rolled it out everywhere and just, were fat, dumb, and happy, thought this is going to be great. Well, no. Right? There's the idea of live testing in one region at a time or something like that, where the problem can be isolated. You just have to do that way.
So, yeah, we can on out of top of our heads, we can name three specific issues in the last 12 to 15 months. Can you name one or two from Azure, from Amazon? Sorry,
didn't they have an entire availability zone go down? Availability East.
Well, that's it. That's
during a storm.
No, but that's a zone going down. That's different from globally.
But it still affected. No, but it still affected certain customers.
It affected the ones that did not have high availability over multiple data centers.
Yeah, for those that hadn't figured out how to work with multiple zones. I don't even know the right language to talk about it. I apologize, but
yeah.
So I'm definitely okay with the whole zone going down. I have no issues with that. But if you go down with 12 of your 15 zones and the ones that stay there are Brazil and Japan, I'm sorry. That's not going to cut it.
And the thing I like about Chaos Monkey is that it follows the rules of software development and testing, which is your developers don't do the testing. And I'm not sure that that's true with Azure, right? And the idea of Chaos Monkey is you just let anybody go in there and make weird stuff happen, right? You just try to break it. And I don't think Microsoft really tries to break Azure.
I want a Chaos Monkey that can attack to all the clouds, not just AWS.
I want to be the Chaos Monkey. Let me break stuff. It's going down.
Hans, that might be a very good future for you. I think you would be a kick-ass Chaos Monkey.
Yeah, absolutely. industry news. Next up, we have Primary Data just came out of stealth, and they look to be an SDS player in the kinds of Viper. There's not a lot available, but one of the things that I have seen is that they have the same message into dividing the control plane, separated from the from the data plane, and that kind of looks like true SDS if you look at it from the SDN perspective, and forget about the storage that is just software. This is splitting control plane from data plane. Am I looking at it right?
Yeah, I think there's a data analytics aspect to it that's much more at the focus and center of what they're doing than it is so much a virtualization of storage. When I initially looked at it, I thought it was more along the lines of understanding that data, kind of what Quadra is doing and Data Gravity.
Data Gravity, yeah.
I don't know, Gabriel. I don't see it that way. When I look at the materials that were released, it looks like, that's what's kind of being said about it. I think more is being said than what they say. To me, it looks like NAS aggregation, and global namespace stuff. And this stuff has been tried before many times and typically not worked, right? They're selling heads. They're mm-hmm. selling. They're selling systems that have storage underneath it. And believe me, many people have tried and fallen on their swords aggregating NAS systems underneath them.
Well, it's not really NAS, because in the baseline, it already says block, file, and object. So it's
worse than NAS. It's everything.
Primary data platform enhances existing infrastructure to optimize resources. With data virtualization, enterprises can quickly respond to new opportunities, shorten time to market, improve productivity, and support SLA agreements.
Yeah, that's marketing BS.
Yes, yeah. So, who's going to support this? If you're EMC, for instance, are you going to support, you know, these things in front of you? No,
because they have Viper.
No. If you're HP, are you going to support this? No. If you're NetApp, are you going to support this? No. Right. I just don't see it happening. Right. I see there are a lot of logistical and operational issues here that are going to keep it from happening. Plus the fact that, you know, the last company to really try to like make this work was F5. I think they still have a product based on Acopias and what they bought from the technology from Attune. And that's not a business for them.
It looks to me more almost similar to what kind of something to what Actifio is doing as well. And they've been in the space for a long time. And, you know, it's they're a company you don't hear a whole lot about, but, you know, they have a pretty strong back, executive team around that product. And they've kind of been around for a while. In fact, I think I looked at them back in 2010 or 2009. Mm-hmm. But, you know.
So if that is not going anywhere, what is the WAS doing there? So they actually. They brought the WAS on board. Is he there for the same reason as he was at Fusion.io?
Absolutely, dancing with the stars.
Mm-hmm.
The WAS isn't going to invent anything here. He doesn't have depth in this area.
I mean, that's what this call. What is it? A figurehead. He lends cachet.
Second time he's doing that.
Believe me, the WAS is not figuring out metadata scalability strategies for these guys.
No, that's why I'm asking.
Could have been his biggest hobby. I have no idea.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess he was like, you know, rub his head at Fusion.io. You know, the Fusion.io guys, they want something else to do, right? So where do they think they can do it? Just because they, you know, it's interesting they get all this money to go do this thing. And it says something about the VC industry, too, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, well, these guys were good at Fusion.io.
They were not. They were in the beginning.
They were good at bringing a product to market and getting the VCs paid.
They were good in 2011. Oh, getting the VCs paid, that exit, I don't know what happened there, but that was just wrong.
What happened there was SanDisk Bottom, right?
And for way too much money.
And Fusion.io had one really big customer, which was Facebook.
Two customers made up 62% of their business. It was Facebook and... I want to say the other one was, it wasn't Twitter. It might have been MySpace.
Facebook then. We'll get back to Facebook.
I mean, but it was, like I said, it was 62% of their business came from two customers.
Right.
There are other reasons. I mean, it's amazing that they went public with that being the case. And I think what you are seeing is there are other companies out there that have a similar model that have not gone public because of that.
So I'm thinking that primary data gets funded not because of the idea that they have, but because of the team.
And the team
includes WAS. What does that say about the funding?
Yeah.
I think WAS could fund it all himself if he wanted to. I mean, let's get real.
Let's get into some final stuff here. So except for industry news, we also have a few small product updates. One of them was Nimble Storage adding Fiber Channel as physical and protocol. What's happening there? I mean, I know they have an issue with iSCSI not going beyond what they want, but is adding Fiber Channel going to be the issue? Going to be the solution there?
It brings them into more enterprise customers is what it does. I mean, look at it this way. They had a 77% jump in quarterly revenues. They're doing something right.
They have to have Fiber Channel, right? You go to talk to the big financial companies, the pharmaceutical companies, insurance companies, and all that. It's if you don't have Fiber Channel, you don't have a prayer.
You're not going to get into any of those. It opens up new opportunities and bigger markets for them. So let's be realistic here. You know, companies like Nimble, I mean, a lot of the smaller storage companies have been feasting on NetApp to an extent. You know, the same way that Equalogic did to a lot of people with you know, when they came out. And because of such, if you want to grow your company and grow your product line and revenues, because it's what the street wants to see, well, you have to add something that will get you into, you know, where the big money's at. And not just the, you know, I sold two units to, you know, this, you know, company X, Y, or Z. I want to go sell 2,000 units to AT&T.
So the big money is in Fiber Channel. Is that...
No, but you only see you see certain companies where Fibre Channel is the only place they're going to put the bulk of their true production ready workloads.
I would agree with that, actually, though, Hans. I would say the big money's in Fibre Channel. It sounds a little funny. The biggest deals are. And this was pushed by sales. It had to be, right? Because yep. sales went out there, and especially in the northeastern United States, where you're trying to sell on Wall Street, in New York, in Pennsylvania, in Massachusetts, right? And if you don't have Fibre Channel, you're not getting in the door. You're not talking to them. They're not interested, period.
Okay.
And so they got sales guys that they're paying a lot of money to, and they're coming back and saying, you know, I don't know this, but I know it, right? Nobody's told me, but I know it. These guys go out there and they knock on these doors. These are guys that have relationships in these accounts. They've worked them, you know, Nimble's hired them from other places, and they've come back and they've said, we can't get in. We're locked out.
How many boxes do they need to sell on those customers to get this type of upgrade in your system? It seems a decent upgrade, or am I misreading this?
There are hundreds of systems in these accounts that are up for grabs, right?
Their strategy has
to be. My bigger question here is, this is a technology change somehow. How difficult from a product management perspective is it to change or add Fibre Channel to iSCSI? I know it's still blocked, but it's not that easy, is it?
No, it's not that easy. They would have added it 18 months ago if they could have, but it takes a long time. You know, and the fact is they can hire good talent, and it still takes a long time to qualify. You know, they have to stand these things up rigorously in these accounts too. So it's not a matter of just saying, you know, we can add this interface and everything will work. It has to really be thoroughly tested, and you go through vendor selection and all that. And I'm sure it was fast-tracked. I don't mean fast-tracked in the way I'm not trying to suggest that they took shortcuts, because I don't believe that Nimble is the kind of company that does that.
No, definitely not. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, they had over 40 customers where they test run this before they went brought it into GA.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. I think they're a very serious storage company.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, a lot of it too is I guarantee you is on the roadmap 5 years ago. Nobody goes into the storage marketplace without evaluating all of the different protocols that are out there and focusing on the ones they think will get them the strongest, quickest growth initially in order for them to develop the tech around some of the others. It has to be part of your roadmap as a storage vendor, unless you know you just don't want to have the broadest reach from a customer base standpoint. If you're 100% NFS, you're always going to be perpetually locked out of a certain level of competition or a certain, you know, that global 5,000 customer base, right?
Because, yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that, Gabriel. It was roadmap a long time ago.
I look at it this way. I mean, look at this. Look at 3PAR and the kind of roadmap they have. I think they've always thought that, or they've always, you know, their model is an ASIC model. They had to have baked deduplication into that ASIC at some point early on in the process, because it takes a long time to spin up a chip. You know, so these storage guys, I mean, the storage companies are not stupid. They realize that they kind of have to have a lot of different, all options are on the table. It's which one is more expedient at the moment or at the go-to-market strategy period versus which one can help us achieve, you know, once we've crossed the chasm, which one can get us to the top of the peak and then have that longevity of a run.
Mm-hmm. To summarize the comments you had and what my suspicion was, is that this is sales-driven and it is not that big of a news for the rest of the world other than the ones that were shut out because of sales?
Actually, I think it's big news for NetApp because it brings Nimble into stronger competition into certain places that NetApp has been able to keep them at bay because they didn't have Fibre Channel.
That's a fairly good point.
But, you know, NetApp, I would hazard a guess they probably don't even do 5% of their business as Fibre Channel.
Then maybe it's a bigger deal to EMC.
When I was at Emulex and I went to NetApp Insight to present about 16 gig Fibre Channel in 2012, I had 5 people in my session.
Yeah, I've had presentations of 5 people, and don't remind me of that, please.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's because I was the one presenting. Yeah.
Maybe it's a bigger deal to EMC and VNX.
So while we're at protocols and connectivity, We actually come to the final point that I have in my agenda of today, is that Mellanox has added a 100 gig HBA for InfiniBand. And my bigger question here, and probably Gabriel's going to disagree with me on that, is how viable is InfiniBand in this world where Ethernet wins and apparently not wins everywhere, where Fibre Channel is, but how viable is InfiniBand in this world, and especially to 100 gig backend?
So it's not that product is not targeting the end user space for the vast majority of it, I would think. I think there's specific verticals they would want to approach from that, i.e. the high performance computing space, but also interconnects. So there's an entire business out there of companies selling parts of their technology to other companies to use as a solution. You know, there are a lot of storage or, you know, scale out storage companies or scale out storage technologies that use InfiniBand internally as an interconnect. And that's what that's geared towards. It's the same thing. It's a backplane technology right now. It's not, you know, other than maybe the financials, the people that are doing high frequency trading. And even then they're more about latency than anything else than bandwidth. It's a technology you leverage inside, say, a converged infrastructure platform or a rack-based technology.
So, yeah, what are the latency differences between this and whatever the current IB is? Is there any latency difference?
I would think. I don't know. I mean, I'd have to go and look at it because unless they've changed their encoding to go from the way fiber channel from 8 gig fiber channel went from 64 from 810 to 64/66. You wouldn't see a change in the latency. Mm-hmm. It would just be 100% bandwidth driven.
Look, no, just help me out here for 1 second, because I still have that Ethernet question in the back of my mind. If I have a 100 gig InfiniBand HBA or backends, and I have a 100 gig Ethernet backend, not speaking about any protocols you're using, it could be lossless, point A to point B, no switches involved, blah, 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 blah. Why would I want to choose that InfiniBand instead of an Ethernet?
It could very well be that the platform you develop on, you can't leverage or you don't want to do the effort. You've always been an InfiniBand technology. Do you want to make the swap from InfiniBand to Ethernet?
How many InfiniBand technologies are there?
Well, as terms of an interconnect for a storage platform, that's where I see the most InfiniBand, and then obviously within high performance computing. And a few others that use that want this kind of consistent persistence of experience at the storage layer. Let's take for instance. I won't name the storage product, but there are several storage products out there today use InfiniBand as an interconnect. The R&D effort and the programmatical effort to switch them off of InfiniBand to Ethernet could be substantial. It could be 6 months. It could be 12 months. Or they could just upgrade to the current InfiniBand and get all the extra bandwidth between the heads or the units, or storage nodes.
No, fair point there.
But InfiniBand even doesn't even touch the vast majority of enterprise customers for their traditional workload. Like I said, it's more. I think this is more of a product that's geared. In fact, I mean, we'd have to talk to somebody at Mellanox why they're positioning this, because 100 gig Ethernet's being positioned to the telcos. 40 gig Ethernet's positioned to the telcos, 52 gigabit for InfiniBand today, and then you have 32 gigabit fiber channel and 128 gig fiber channel on the horizon.
Well, and the employees of Mellanox have to have something to do.
Yeah.
I mean, what else? What else are they going to do?
Doubling bandwidth. Yay. All right, guys, I think we could wrap it up here. We had a fair amount of content in this episode. It was very good speaking to you. And in closing, we still have our secret Windows Phone app.
Hello, this is Mark Farley, and you're listening to Secret Windows Phone Apps. And today, we're going to be talking about something that's very, very secret.
I love you.
Like the Fantasy Football app. You know, the game within a game, where people don't really cheer for teams anymore. They just cheer for a bunch of players from a bunch of different teams to see if they can get more points than their friends or enemies or lovers or haters. And it doesn't really include anything about the coaches or special teams or the referees or defense and and your fantasy football team can really get screwed up if one of your main players turns out to be a sex offender or a pot smoker or something like that. In other words, fantasy football has some real problems when it comes head-to-head with reality. So why bother? This week's Fantasy Football app is something you completely make up. The app doesn't exist. In fact, the teams and players don't even have to exist. You can just sit in your room or your closet or your bathtub or under the crawl space or something like that. And you can put your fingers in your eyes and imagine all kinds of wonderful plays and players and leagues and all that stuff all on your own. And you can imagine beating your boss or your wife without getting into a lot of trouble and sitting in the doghouse for a week. This Windows Secret Phone Fantasy Football app allows you to make up all the rules. So you don't have officials making bad plays for you. Or rather, they can enforce the rules, your evil rules on the game. And let's face it, if you're going to be God of fantasy football, and who doesn't want to be that, you better win the game, because that's really what it's about. In fantasy football, or real football, or life, or anything, just win, baby. Just do it. Win. Tune in again to hear another episode of Secret Windows Phone Apps.